Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Word is proud media partner of Latitude Festival. For more information and to purchase tickets, go to www.latitudefestival.co.uk.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
In the reign of Jockey Cranner,
yeah,
we had the professionals on the cover, who were Steve Jones, Paul Cook, and another.
Oh, right. Bloke with long hair.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, very long play. Played the bass. Yeah, very long hair.
Oh, really?
He was a great thuggish-looking individual.
Yes, he didn't belong.
He was probably the diamond geezer, then, underneath it.
He would certainly be the diamond geezer. And
talk about a walk-on part in the rich history of rock and roll.
Dave thinks they never released a single.
Who?
The professionals.
Did they?
I thought they had one quite good record.
I think Jockey was so keen to come on there. Indeed.
Why, though?
Well, because anything to do with the Sex Pistols, literally anything at that point.
Was commercial? Was it?
I bet it was. I bet they're on the cover of the NME.
Because you see, the interesting thing about punk rock is it was commercial years after it had happened.
They were on the cover of the NME.
Suddenly all the teenagers in Britain caught up with this thing after the Sex Pistols had broken up and whatever. And started ordering their mail order bondage trousers and so forth, and wanting anything that was punk, didn't they?
Yeah, no, it became sort of pop, didn't it, really?
Yeah, it's like
in America. Christoph just talked the other day about the fact that America has got house music with David Guetta. And I said, well, remember, they did get punk with Billy Idol.
Right.
It's an actual delay.
That'll teach them. No, look,
of course, we love Sir William Idol.
But, Sir William, I know.
I've got to ask you this question, Neil. This was sent in by Gagarin, who always sends a question. If it kicked off between Pet Shop Boys and Sparks, who'd win?
Well, it did kick off.
He stumbled on a on a rich seam.
On a raw nerve.
No, there was the thing in... this is all fine now, by the way.
Yeah, go on.
But in another monthly rock magazine, one of Sparks said... was talking about their massive influence on pop duos. He said, there are actually Pet Shop Boys songs that we've written. And I got really annoyed. And
That's illegal.
I actually sent a letter to Q. And they printed it. Needless to say, the week it was published, who should I bump into at rehearsal studios in West London but Sparks?
Was it a cordial exchange?
They were very apologetic and very nice.
Were they?
So that's when it nearly kicked off.
Oh, right.
But it didn't.
So he stumbled upon something.
Yeah.
And loads of questions about why you're touring with Take That.
Why we're touring with Take That? Well, because they asked us.
It's a good reason, isn't it?
They asked us.
Wouldn't you? It's a stadium tour, isn't it?
Well, actually, it is. They asked us and we turned it down. And then they were working with Stuart Price on their album. And Stuart is married to our manager, Angela Beckham. And they all said to Stuart, why won't they do it? And so we thought about it again, and they said that we were going to actually be part of the show. Because in the show, you know, you've got Take That as 4, Take That as 5, and Robbie Williams. And you've also got...
Oh, I see. So it's a drama within a...
Yes.
Don't tell me Robbie Williams comes on last. That would be clever. I've probably already said
too much.
Oh, my God, that would be...
But anyway, you know, I mean, they are playing in Manchester 7 nights at a stadium.
That's...
Our agent was telling us that he has American promoters phoning up saying, "What is this take that thing?"
Yeah, I bet.
Because there's actually no one in the world could play 7 nights at a stadium in Manchester, apart from Take That.
So what's that? Seven
couldn't get the Rolling Stones. U2 struggled to play two.
Even the Foo Fighters.
Was it 50,
actually, it's not seven.
Three.
It's eight. It's seven Wembley Stadiums.
Was it 50,000 a time?
Seven Wembley Stadiums.
Oh, God.
Now, I think the only act that could ever have done this historically would have been Michael Jackson, wouldn't it?
I suppose so.
I don't think at anyone's height, I don't think Madonna could have done that, or U2 at their absolute peak could have done
how
eight
could you,
nights.
So they are now the biggest British group of all time, but measured
like
by
in
that.
Britain, yeah. Four nights at Sunderland.
And, you know Sunderland.
Yeah. Funny enough, I don't know Sunderland very well. But Sunderland Stadium of Light.
There was a further question on the Take That front. That's sort of why we're doing it. I've lost the question, actually, that said, inspired by Take That, have you ever thought about kicking Chris out and then letting him back in?
Chris and I have always often discussed that, but it's a shame we've never broken up.
The reunion tour.
So yes,
it's a brilliant idea. With two solos and a reunion. With Chris sort of in a corner on the stage, having to look slightly less grumpy than usual. As if he's really pleased. Hi, waving.
Looking contrite.
That's very good. That'd be good. Look, I wanted to read something out that I found out in the attic. And I don't know, I was going to want to read two things. I'll start with this one, actually. I want the viewers to guess who... Well, you probably can guess who the author of this piece is, actually, because we're talking to him. But you've got to guess who he's writing about. This is how the piece opens, the first paragraph. It says, "Mark's feeling a bit chesty today."
Oh, I remember this.
"He's got to go and see a specialist tomorrow. There's no mistaking him when he walks into the room with his headband and mascara, black clothes and two different earrings. Only a bad cough and sudden bursts of nervous laughter interrupt his continuous staccato chatter." It is, in fact, David. It's the cover story of Smash Hits.
Mark Arman.
It's Mark Arman.
Soft
sell. July the 8th.
So what year are we talking about?
July the 8th, 1982. And look, here's another one. I've got to read you this. It's brilliant. And this is a prophetic review by Neil Tennant in the reviews. Oh, when was this one? This is Bauhaus on the cover, October 28th, 82. It's of a Grandmaster Flash and the Furious 5 record, The Message.
Good record.
And it says, exactly, it says, "In 50 years' time, when your grandchildren return from their late 20th century popular music class at school, they'll probably cluster around your armchair and ask, 'Granddad, what was rap?'" It's good, isn't it?
It's very
this
good.
Is good. Wait, no, no. Flipping on this good. LP, you'll be at a loss to explain why the Grandmaster of Rap actually sings a bunch of substandard disco songs. Oh, actually, yes.
Sorry.
Do you know, I didn't read the second part.
You know what that is?
But the point is...
It's the album.
It's yes. The album.
Was rubbish. Yeah. The single, of course, is a masterpiece.
Now, that review is clearly inspired by Tony Barrow's Sleeve Notes for Beatles for Sale. In which he says, in the year 1990 or whatever, so he wrote this 65, 66 or whatever.
Yeah.
"You ask some cigar-smoking kid on Venus, he asks you what the 60s were all about. Don't try and explain about the Screams, just play him this record. He'll get the same sense of well-being from it as we do now." And it was the only true thing ever written on a sleeve note.
Which record was that?
Beatles for Sale. Beatles for Sale, isn't it? It's Tony Barrow wrote that.
Yes, I think it is Beatles for Sale.
And I think you were borrowing that. You didn't know you were doing it.
Yeah. No, it might have been a deliberate reference.
Oh, it could have been homage.
So when you read that stuff, when you hear that stuff quoted from years ago, can you remember writing it?
I have no recollection at all of the Message album review. Although, actually, Phil, if I can picture the album cover, the Mark Arman one, I remember quite clearly.
Right.
But there's another... I mean, I'm not
Mark Arman, of course, lest we forget, was one of Britain's biggest pop stars at that point.
He was huge.
I think that was written when they had... You know, they made, like, five... They had a stream of, like, five amazing singles from Tainted Love, Bedsitter, Torch, and I think this one was called Why. And then they went more underground, didn't they? And it was less pop-tastic.
And what I love, because I found quite a few of your things, because as anyone
that's a good picture
know,
of
great picture.
It's Wow. Nick Hayward.
No, it's great, isn't it? But as anyone who doesn't know, is that Neil worked on Smash Hits with myself and briefly you, Dave. In fact, Dave, didn't you give Neil a job?
You gave me the job.
I gave you a job.
I think so.
I remember negotiating Neil's salary in the caf round the corner. As Neil thought, even if I don't get the package I'm looking for, 4,000 or whatever, 8,000, I can't remember, he thought, I'm going to get a good meal out of this. I never forgot this. I said, do you want pudding? He said, yes, I'm having pudding.
Fill your boots.
He had apple pie and That's custard. Great. I remember this clearly.
Was it at the... what was it called?
I can't remember.
The Bombier, whatever it was.
No, it wasn't. It was one in Lexington Street. I can't remember. Anyway, go.
I love the fact that... I mean, here's one from where you interview 2 19-year-olds from Bushy Hearts.
Oh, yeah.
Who play all British rap and funk. I meet all sorts in this job, claims Neil Tennant.
Right? You've written me.
Sorry. Yeah. But what I love about it is that already Neil Tennant has changed his agenda in terms of his interviewing these people to something far more professional, far more to do with actually making music than the average 12-year-old reader would want to know. So when he talks to George and Andrew of Wham, he says, we hated what our producer was doing, so we sacked him, says Andrew with a grin. George did the remix while I fell asleep. Probably a modus operandi adoption by the Pet Shop Boys. It is, very. But it's brilliant. And I remember you going to interview Marilyn. That was a classic. Do you remember that one?
I think it was my last feature.
When are we talking about?
It was great because on the plane on the way there, apart from the punters, was me, Mariella Frostrup, and Lynn Barber.
Good God.
No.
Yeah.
All going to Marilyn
to interview
duty.
Marilyn.
Touch the head
well, actually,
of Marilyn
Mariella
gun.
Was doing the press, of course.
Yes,
of course
she was.
And it was... No, it was.
So where did you go? Where was this taking place?
It was in New York. Marilyn was staying at an uber-cool hotel, one of the first... by the guy that owns the Royalton and all those things.
Yeah.
Put his name now. And...
Schrager.
Ian Schrager, the first Schrager Hotel. It was very... And we were in this room that was incredibly minimal. First really minimal interior I ever walked into, and it was incredibly dark. And Marilyn was in a very miserable mood, for actually perfectly good reasons, really, as the piece points out. And then he had this amazingly cool launch party for his album at the Club Area in New York, which had live art installations. And they had loads of people dressed as Marilyn Monroe standing on grids with air blowing up. So they were doing the 7-year itch.
Fantastic.
It was amazing.
Is that a live art installation too?
Yeah, it was a totally amazing thing. Anyway, then Marilyn comes on to sing Calling Your Name or something. And he sort of shuffles on a bit, actually. And then there's a scream of feedback as he opens his mouth. And he looks bewildered and walks off. And as I cruelly said, he walks off the stage and never should return.
Never return.
Yeah. That was it, was it?
Again.
That was his...
Swan song.
That was his...
Yeah. That was his moment.
That was his...
Actually, the high point of Marilyn's moment was when you were on Jim Will Fix It with Marilyn Ellen.
Oh, that was great. Yes.
Which was... Yeah.
Well, I've still got a tape of that, actually. And it was a long period of time when I actually used to play that. You know, people came around for supper or something. And people started to demand it. You know, in the same way as people bring out a fine brandy or a cigar, they would want
you
to
get
see
out an LVH,
me
yes.
on Jim Will Fix It with Jimmy Savile. And Jimmy Savile, who calls me Mr. Music, doesn't he? Do you remember?
Mr. Smash Hits.
No, here we are.
Because he can't
Music,
remember your name.
He can't remember that. Mr. Yeah. Mr. Music. And Marilyn, who is just absolutely hilarious. And we were backstage, I can remember, there was some... Do you remember how Jim Will Fix It? There used to have people from the armed forces or the services.
Yeah, always.
And they had a load of very attractive blokes dressed up in Victorian firefighting uniforms, which Marilyn was, who was enormously interested in them. Had to be prized away from that dress and come on stage.
What was the nature of this child's wish?
Oh, very good question. A girl had her... She wanted Jim to fix it that she could be on the cover. Do you remember?
It was actually a bit of a deal done, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Everything on Jim Will Fix It wasn't.
So yeah. We're not with Marilyn. She just wanted to be on the cover of Smash Hits. So it was up to me to find a cooperative pop star who would... play along with us, and he was so desperate for publicity. Duran Duran would have felt a bit above all this, but he was desperately wanted to be on the cover. It was just a living nightmare, the whole thing.
It is amazing, though. We're just saying, before we started recording, though, you're looking at these old copies of Smash Hits, and you've got Peter Murphy of Bauhaus is on the cover of Smash Hits.
Well, Bauhaus used to be on Top of the Pops.
I suppose we forget.
And also Smash Hits was much more what we would now call indie.
Yes.
Than people remember it. And also it was more earnest. You remarked in talking about Wham, I'm unbelievably writing about the music.
Oh, yeah. It's astonishing.
Wouldn't enter anyone's head now. No. But unbelievably, in those days, one wrote about the music as well. And that is because it had a very serious agenda, as well as, you know, this sort of humour and glossy pictures.
But it also worked on the principle that, as evidenced by the fact we used to print the song words, is that the relationship between the people reading these articles and the music was incredibly close, wasn't it? The lyrics.
Yes.
What they meant, the soap opera of these songs and how they reflected on their lives, was fantastically important.
The thing I find myself thinking about most, with most amazement when I look back on Smash Hits in the early 80s, is that every night the 13, 14, 15-year-olds of Britain went home, they got out their Friends Forever notepaper and a pen, and they actually wrote joined-up thoughts about who they'd like to see in the magazine, or responding to something that somebody said in an interview, or have you got the lyric wrong? And they did this in their thousands.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something that's disappeared from the culture.
Well, surely people would send emails now.
Yeah, but they don't send emails. They tend to communicate via your website or whatever. Yes. You know, they're involved in a kind of rolling.
I mean, have you ever read the Pop Justice Forum?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
Peter Robinson's.
According to Peter Robinson, it's only about 12 people apparently. It's 12 sort of maniacs, you know.
But they write 24 hours.
But they write. Yeah. They pretty much do, but they're older than what you're in your 12, 13-year-old. But they write often quite considered stuff about marketing and they seem to understand how everything works in a way that people didn't used to.
But they were starting to get to understand it, I think at that point. But I just can't get over the amount of energy that was used in that kind of thing. And I remember the first time we had a reader's poll, a proper reader's poll.
This is it, the one I've got here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think there were 40,000 entries.
Oh, God, there was always tons.
And they sat there in sacks.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, kids,
we counted them.
We bloody counted them.
We all used to get drafted in.
We would get drafted, yeah.
We didn't work on the weekend or whatever. Yeah. Used to have long, huge, great boards, like kind of cricket averages or something like that.
Exactly.
And you go, George, most fanciable
man in pop.
And somebody would go, every time they got a vote. And then when there was 10, they would cross it through. They'd round them up.
And each of those postcards would be sent by somebody who had not just sent the postcard and got the address, but
postcard.
Postcard. I know. But they would also have coloured it in. They would colour the bordering. And they would have coloured it in and put little jokes on the front.
Oh, absolutely.
And probably sort of thought bubbles. If there's a picture postcard with somebody on it, we'd be sort of saying, thought bubble would be saying, I'd love to meet Neil Tennant. He's dreamy. Do you know what I mean? And they would fill in the little eyes and above the letter I. The little dots would be filled in or whatever.
It feels to me like a completely vanished world. I was reminded of this recently. We're clearing out the attic at home, and I found an old copy of The Guardian from 1981. When did you join Smash Hits?
82.
Okay. 1981, TV listings. How many TV stations in Britain?
Has Channel 4 launched yet?
No, three. That's the clue.
Three.
Yeah. It's astonishing.
There's no breakfast television.
No, that launches in 82, I think.
Well, yeah, possibly.
Disastrously.
Everything closes at midnight.
Sensibly, yeah. Why doesn't now, really?
Everybody goes home and gets some sleep.
And there's no soaps on the telly.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a golden age, obviously.
Yes. Oh, we were happy then.
The thing that strikes you is it's the 1970s, really. It's not the 80s. That's still the 1970s.
Yeah.
You know, what we think of as the 80s. Yeah. Is a lot later, isn't it? You know,
it's one of the
massive explosion
arguments.
Of stuff.
You know, the long 80s versus the short 80s. I think the 80s is really short.
When did the 80s start?
The 80s starts probably, if we do it in strictly pop terms, probably with Culture Club at the end of 82.
Oh,
and
right.
By 88, it's house music's come in. Right. It's all over.
So the 90s has started.
The 90s.
It started earlier.
In the same way, the 60s, I think, is just really 63, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then 68, the beards.
Yeah, beard, prog, long guitar solo.
And it's the 70s, which is going to last till middle of 1982.
That was so John Savage, though. Yeah. Remember John Savage?
I saw the John Savage that I talk about endlessly.
I know. I remember John Savage ringing me up once, and I was talking about the band. The band. He said, "You can hear the beards." Which I love that idea. Put the phone down at me.
Well, Danny Baker always says that about the 70s, that if you look at the first part of the 70s, you know, I don't know, between Woodstock and the Sex Pistols.
Between Woodstock and the Sex Pistols.
The staggering amount of change in that short period of time has never been duplicated.
Reggae, disco, glam.
Yeah, kind of Steely Dan, singer-songwriters.
Yeah, computer.
Absolutely everything.
Synthesizer rock.
It's extraordinary when you look back on it. So,
looking at the results, I just wondered if you two could possibly guess, Fraser 2, in 1982, who the readers voted as the most promising new acts.
Oh,
1982. Probably, I might have given some clues about my shit.
Well, Wham! Wham must be.
Wham are there, number four, actually.
Yeah.
In with the Bullet, number four. Musical Youth, of course, number three. Above them is Culture Club. The readers thought were promising, they might go somewhere. Tears for Fears, number one. Lower down, it gets a bit wobbly. Blue Zoo.
Spandau Ballet?
What happened? Spandau Ballet, I think we're established. Already established.
Well,
Farmer's Boy is 18.
Bands have come up and started. We're secretly thinking they've gone down the dumper, but they're about to come up with the truth.
That's me hoping.
See, I was listening to ACDC.
Spandau.
Still funny.
Still funny.
Spiny Norman.
Mary was... We went out for a meal about 15 years ago. You and me, and I think Dave Rimmer was there. He used to write for Smash Hits. Yeah. And Birchie, and also John Savage. And we played this incredibly funny game, which was... Who was the person that we'd all... Which were the bands we'd all interviewed the most? Can you remember that? And we'd all interviewed Paul Weller four times.
Oh, yeah, I interviewed Paul
Weller. I think we'd all interviewed Culture Club five times.
Paul Weller sent me a copy of his last album.
Did he? No.
Paul Weller sent me a copy of his last album.
With a note?
Pretty good album, actually.
Yeah,
that's what some people say.
There's a very track three, which I forgot the name of it now. It's a really, really good song. Anyway, with a little note, it was very.
So did it refer to Smash It? Did you remember the old? Did it mention anything? Because you interviewed him. In fact, there's a review of
several
the last
times. I interviewed him. I was the Paul Weller correspondent for a while.
I was the police correspondent. You were the.
I was mostly Mary Wilson, I think. Who I hearted. But Neil reviewed the Jam's final concert at Wembley Arena. Do you
Absolutely,
remember that?
I certainly do.
Yeah, the tears in his eyes.
Tears.
Probably sizing up Wembley Arena yourself in your head, thinking, we can take this.
No, I don't think I was thinking that.
No, but I'll tell you, the person we all interviewed the most was Bananarama. We'd all interviewed Bananarama, I think, six times.
Now, I only interviewed Bananarama once.
Oh, was it?
And... Actually, we occasionally see Bananarama, and I've even discussed this with Siobhan Fahey before, because I said to her, you were shaking with nerves.
Really?
She was, Siobhan.
To be interviewed by Smash Hits.
I don't, And she said she used to get really nervous. Whereas the other two...
Yeah.
I
interviewed Bananarama, and they must have been... Oh, they were very young. I think she was about 19, Siobhan. And they were just so excited that Eugene Manzi, our old pal, who was doing the press, said, look, girls, I'll tell you what, I'll get you a lunch. And they said, where do you want to go? And they said they wanted to go to Burger King, which had just opened, actually, in Central London. And Burger King had a new offer, right, which was... I can't remember what it was called now, but it was basically a triple burger. It was like a three-quarter-pound burger with cheese. And they because it was free food, I think, they just said, come on. And they ate, each tried to eat a three-quarter-pound burger, and then were absolutely hopeless to interview, because they were just lying around saying, I don't feel very well.
Wasn't that the day when you took Bananarama out on the town
for
the day?
Oh, yeah,
for
yeah.
the cover feature?
Yeah.
Now,
with a Charles and Di lookalike, how very topical that is now. We'd have a Kate and Wills lookalike now. You're absolutely right.
This is 1981 monument. Again, you see. Yeah. That's why I was asked to talk about this on the radio. Yeah. Because didn't you take them to London Zoo?
I did. London Zoo. We took them up the fire
Innocent
monument.
Times.
We took the Buckingham Palace with a Charles and Di lookalike. It was hilarious. Cost a lot of money, that feature, actually.
What's the most ridiculous thing you've, Pet Shop Boys, have ever been asked to do in the name of press, Neil?
Well, the thing we used to get asked to do about once a month, but this was in the late 80s, sorry.
Back on microphone.
Back on microphone. We used to get asked to do a lot was, we've had a great idea for a feature, we go shopping with the Pet Shop Boys.
Oh, right. Oh, yes.
We go S-H-O-P-P-I-N-T with the Pet Shop Boys. And we've never done it. But it was just saying, sorry, no.
No, I'm sure.
The enemy used to do that every time there was a skinhead group. They would take the skinheads bowling. Because there was a hilarious song. Do you remember? Take this camera. It was, it's Cabba Van Beethoven, actually. It's come back to me. So, yes, the headline does this. We've mentioned this in Word 100. I went through all the old issues, all 99 of them, and found some great headlines, which had obviously, that's the idea of the feature was simply the headline. One was called Hitler, My Part in His Download. Andrew Harrison found an article about the Third Reich Chancellor had been scanned and put on a website. It's all about him showing you around his country retreat in Austria in 1936.
I was trying to remember last night, Neil. You were briefly at Smash Hits. We used to call you Chili T.
Chili T was because I liked hip-hop and New York dance stuff, and there were a lot of people
everybody
with
had
names
like that.
Chili T.
Yeah.
It was actually Linda Duff that christened me Chili T.
Who did the Get Smart column.
Who did the Get Smart column and went on. Because actually, when I was leaving Smash Hits to do the Pet Shop Boys full-time, I was amazingly approached by the Sun to ask if I'd like to write the Bizarre column.
Good God, I never knew that.
As Neil Tennant?
As Neil Tennant, the guy from Smash Hits. And I said, no, actually, I'm leaving to do this thing. And I said, but there's a young woman here who I know wants to do journalism, and she has a lot about pop music. And so they interviewed Linda. Because of that, she through very circuitous routes, she entered the Mirror and then the Star.
Yeah.
I don't think she ever actually did much at the Sun, but...
You were also known as Dr. Bits, weren't you? Were you known as Dr. Bits?
I was known as Dr. Bits,
because you were in charge of the... The
front
the section,
the news section was called Bits.
Yeah. Famously, you employed me because I was in book publishing to do the Smash Hits yearbook.
Absolutely,
actually, I don't remember the lunch, but I'm sure it was you had the lunch. Anyway, nonetheless, on my first day, it was casually mentioned to me when I sat down at my desk that I was the news editor. It was just casually mentioned to me.
That's how you go.
And I, you know, I didn't. I just said, "Oh yeah, okay, fine." But it hadn't. No one had actually said anything about that when I was being employed.
I just had one of those mental flashes when you left. Anybody listening will probably know there's a grand tradition in journalism where somebody leaves
the cover.
You mock up the cover of the magazine, their face, write a load of hilarious cover lines. Well, I'm ashamed to say, listeners, that when Neil Tennant left, having formed a group called the Pet Shop Boys, and the worst thing was that we used to love your records, used to come in with cassettes he'd made with Chris Lowe. Chris would wait in reception for you. Do you remember? And then you go off down to the studio.
Chris actually
would often,
because my desk was famously beside the record player.
Yeah.
Yes.
Chris would often come in and stand and sort of dance a bit.
Yes, he did.
He would actually start sort of giggling a bit.
But I remember you used to make these cassettes, and you made a cassette of...
Of course, Scoffer used to make me copies of them to give to record companies.
That's right.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And the only cassette machine we had at one point was the answer phone. Do you remember this? There was an answer phone. If somebody rang up, it would record a little tiny cassette. And that was the only thing we could play it on. You'd been off to, I think, Molinaire Studios. Am I anywhere near right? Was a studio nearby?
Oh, that was later.
No, you
did the stickers thing at Molinaire.
Oh, well, God, we'll do that in a minute. That's great.
Yes.
But anyway, so Neil used to come in. He's supposed to. And we all thought...
We're going to do that in a minute.
And we all thought... Actually, I've got that at home. We can dub that into this.
It's probably on Pet Shop Boys.
And Neil would come in with his, and I think Dave and I particularly had known various pals who tried to be successful pop musicians with absolutely no success at all. And I used to think, look, no friend of mine will ever be successful. Much as we like
everyone yourself. Thinks that we
and,
all think.
Yeah,
that.
And when Neil,
I thought that about us. Really, to be honest, I didn't really.
Did you?
I didn't really think we would. It was impossible to imagine. And also, having, because of Smash Hits, being close to it all happening, I sort of thought it wouldn't really happen, but I thought I'd have a good year out and it would be fun.
Absolutely. But when you left, we mocked up the cover. Like, I think I can still remember the cover line. In fact, you once talked about this on Radio 1.
I
remember blushing listening to it. And the cover line was something like, it said, Neil Tennant, in big letters, something like, it said, how I gave up my top job on Britain's Brightest Pop Mag, that's right, to form the Pet Shop Boys, and it all went disastrously down the dumper, and I came crawling back and asked for my job back on the Bits Machine, or whatever it was.
Something like that,
by Neil Tennant, See Page 27.
It's like the legend, the lunches.
Yes, it was! And I remember that. And then, sorry, I've got to finish this because it's so extraordinary. Because we gave you the thing, we had a little party, it was great, and you went off. And very, very, very quickly, you had an enormous amount of success. And we were starting Q magazine.
Quick, was it?
No, well, it
because
was about a year.
Of, yeah, you got a false start, didn't you?
We had.
Well, you left it.
The false start, lest we forget, I was still at Smash Hits when Western Girls came out. Because then there was the first Parlophone single, Let's Melt Some Money.
And you had to get out of
that was a total flop.
Right.
But actually, West End Girls
was a remake,
and then but that came out in sort of October, and I left Smash Hits, I think, at the end of March.
Now the thing,
but what happened on that day? I remember was that I knew the record had come out, and it was one of those things where I just thought, I just so hope this record's going to be successful. I just didn't want to think about it. I just didn't want to know that it. I didn't want to look at any charts and see that West End Girls had gone in and at 27 and now was 43 or whatever. And we were working on launching Q Magazine, I think, a little place in Great Bournemouth.
You were, yeah.
And on the day that the charts were announced, I got a call from reception saying, someone to see you. And I said, this is Neil Tennant. And I thought, oh, my God. And I was thinking, well, let's go out and have lunch or something. But I hope he doesn't, I mean, I hope this is going to be embarrassing. I hope the single. And we sat there for a while. And if you remember this, and after a while I said, I plucked up courage, how's it going? And you said, we're number one. we're the number one record in the United Kingdom. I think you'd gone in at something like 10.
Didn't you know?
No, I didn't know. I didn't only, Mark. I was no longer at Britain's Brightest Pop magazine. I was working on Rock Giant Q, and I was thinking probably about Tom Waits.
I was going to demand it to be features editor.
No, that's right. I thought you read it, and you said, oh, we're number one. I can remember thinking, absolutely astonished. It was fantastic.
The thing I remember most...
It was actually a very, very slow process, because in fact it went in at like 116... and went up, and then went to number 80, and then finally it got in the top 40, and then we were number 29, we were on top of the Pops.
Oh, well, I've somehow
and it went on, yeah, it actually, the whole thing, it took actually about almost 3 months to get to number one.
The Word, a magazine, a website, a podcast, a way of life.
The thing I remember most clearly, though, is when you were in New York.
Yeah.
To ostensibly see the police at Chase Stadium.
Well, I did see them.
Okay.
It wasn't good. Ostensible. I did actually write the piece.
I'm still worried that he didn't actually attend the concert.
I know he went. It's my most precious memory of that whole time is that Steve Bush and I had gone out to see Felix Dennis, who wanted to launch Smash Hits in the States.
That's right.
And Neil, at the same time, had gone to New York to do police at Chase Stadium, but also on the quiet to meet his great disco producer hero,
Bobby O. Who you'd made one of his singles, Single of the Week, and Smash Hits.
Oh, well, okay, that's my part of the story.
Yes.
And anyway,
because, I mentioned that because everyone at Smash Hits knew Bobby O's music intimately because it was pounding 24/7 on the office record
player. It was.
Controlled by me.
You're so hot for me, or I'm
you're so hot,
hot
for you. Yeah, that's I'm right. So hot for you.
So
she
hot
has
you.
A way.
We're in the Gramercy Park Hotel.
Yeah.
It's a Friday. I think
it's hot.
Yeah. It's blooming hot.
Yeah.
The sun is blazing in New York. Felix Dennis has moved me into a suite at the Gramercy Park Hotel so that we can have a meeting that weekend. So we arrive back at the hotel. Bushy first time in New York. Neil's gone out there to see his hero.
Oh, I remember.
They've been moved into this suite. Neil turns up and go, how did it go with Bobby O? And then you looked at me, smiled, bisecting your face. He's going to make a record with us. And we just sat there. We had a bucket of ice beers.
We did.
We sat
had a bucket
there
of Budweiser.
And we laughed and laughed
it
and
was
laughed.
So funny. That's so great. Because actually, I was meant to go back that day. And you said, why don't you come and stay at the Gramercy Park Hotel and you can come to this meeting with this Felix Dennis guy and, you know, give a few ideas or something. And so that's why I moved from my hotel down to the Gramercy Park. And it was one of the most amazing days of my life.
We just, your tears rolling down our cheeks.
It's so touching.
We just thought, it's like Jimmy Cagney, it's top of the world, Ma, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And nobody thought it would go to any further than that.
I don't know if I told anyone beforehand I was going to meet Bobby O.
Maybe not.
Because I did it. Because actually, this was a one might assume that given a free trip to New York, the entire office would be gagging to do it.
Yeah.
Au contraire. So I'm with Kimberly doing the 1984 yearbook.
Yeah, that's right.
in what we used to call Sexy Lexi in Lexington Street. And Mark, who's editor, can't get anyone to go to New York because it's just a one-night trip.
It's a one-night trip. It was a short straw because it was the fact to go to a New Jersey stadium.
Shea Stadium.
Yeah.
See the police. You know, I mean, really look back at it now, really, that's quite a tempting offer.
Somebody flew over.
Yeah.
Saw the gig the same day you've flown over. Interview Sting.
Yeah.
At midnight at Shea Stadium. And then fly back the next day. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to go meet Bobby O. There was that funny record company, Pinnacle or something. Mm-hmm. Do you remember they used to release dance records?
Yeah.
And they had a PR. And of course, I used to put their stuff in smash hits because I like those kind of records. And so I phoned her up, and she gave me Bobby O's phone number, and I phoned him up the previous week, and.
So this is our opportunity, Dave, to position ourselves, post-rationalise, and point out the crucial part that both you and I played in the formation of the mighty... I think we had our own trumpet, we'd allow ourselves a little toot.
Just a little peep.
That's extraordinary.
Extraordinary stuff.
So a couple of moments. I tell you what we're going to do in a minute, We're going to do the greatest song. We can do it now. Greatest song ever written.
Well... There obviously is.
I know the answer, by the way.
You know my answer.
I'm just checking to see if you do.
Well, my current greatest song ever written, and this is since watching the George Martin Arena last week.
Which was terrific, yeah.
My current greatest song ever written is Alfie by Burt Bacharach. In this film, you saw great footage of Cilla recording...
In the booth with a 48
totally,
piece.
Totally amazing. Burt Bacharach conducts.
And boy, does he conduct.
Really?
Boy, does
he, physically. Amazing.
And then plays a piano solo.
Yes, he does. And I looked at that and thought, is that dubbed?
Totally. No, it's obviously what. Remember, he was always a musical director and pianist for Marlene
Dietrich.
It's totally amazing. And you've got Cilla. Looks actually amazingly confident. You know, that is... I read an interview with Burt Bacharach where he said that was his favourite recording of any of his songs.
Really?
Anyway, if you listen to Alfie, it's a totally extraordinary song. That if you went through the structure, how it gets to where it gets, it's mind-blowing. It's mind-boggling.
Absolutely. And what's also amazing is presumably he just wrote it to order, didn't he? They wanted the song
and
called Alfie.
It's not in the film.
No.
It's not in the film at all.
Why not? I just read this recently because I've always been mildly obsessed by Alfie, actually, but I was re-obsessed by seeing this programme. And I looked it up and it's not in the... It wasn't in the film.
And also, you can't get over the fact that when you... It sounds like the version that you're seeing filmed there, the version that actually finished up on the record, because it's exactly as you remember. And it is a live recording.
Yeah, you know the story. They recorded... George Martin gets them to record it 19
27
times.
27 takes or something. Right.
And then they use take one.
Well, George Martin, I think, said to Bacharach on the talkback, I think you already have it. He said, if you go back to one or two, or it was, you'll find it's there. He said, I'm looking for the magic. He said, you've got the magic. And this poor girl is just wilting.
Do you believe in that idea, though, that people very often do the best stuff under real commercial pressure? You've got to do it now.
Yes, because somehow it produces the inspiration, I think. And also, you've got no choice. You can't put it off.
Yes.
You know, like when you're a writer or anything, you always want to put things off. And when you've actually got to do it, I know it's not exactly Burt Bacharach, but if you look at the astonishing way someone can get on a roll, like Stock Aitken and Waterman, always maligned, but if you look at that run of hits they have,
oh,
and actually,
it's phenomenal.
How many surprisingly pretty amazing pop songs are out there? And they were on a roll, churning them out.
Well, Ray Davies.
If you look at something that used to be regarded a bit like Stock in the Waterman at the time, which everyone forgets now, Tamla and Motown.
Yeah.
When Holland, Dozier, Holland are just churning them out.
Yeah.
It's an amazing...
And Ray Davies, between about 64 and 67, had 17 consecutive phenomenal hits.
Yeah,
And B-sides like I Go to Sleep, you know, just...
Yeah, stuff chucked
B-sides
like
B-side. Is that a B-side?
Yeah, I Go to Sleep.
I never knew that song until...
Astonishing.
Yeah.
Go on, a couple more. Greatest songs ever written.
I've been in my house in Durham the last 2 weeks, and a few years ago, John Savage gave me a bootleg CD of the album Never Released Smile by Beach Boys. Yeah. All you rock critics like.
Which is coming out. And,
Yes, mega classic, mate.
Anyway, I put it on in the car. I was driving around the moors in Durham, listening to. And actually, I didn't. It was very good, but to be fair, it's
could do better.
It's
see me.
It's a bootleg someone's imagined and put together. But it made me think what an unbelievably amazing record Heroes and Villains is.
Really?
Yeah.
By the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
It's a totally amazing.
All the different sections.
All the different sections. Yeah. The
movements.
The depth of harmony in it, and also the way the harmony is also a rhythmic, a very strong rhythmic part. It's a really, it's difficult to get your head around that record.
I think you listen to that and you realise why Brian Wilson went mad.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much stuff going on, you don't know how you could cope.
Yeah, but you know what, it all sits in there. It doesn't sound contrived. If you listen to Good Vibrations, which is possibly the best record ever made as well,
yeah,
you can sort of hear the edit when it goes down to the organ or whatever it is.
That's
the
bass. There's a drop off, isn't it?
Now, the John Savage bootleg that he gave me, that's on there as well, isn't it? Good Vibrations. And it's a different, it's not the same as a single version. Anyway, so I went home and I made a CD of my favourite Beach Boys records. I like that period. I like the psychedelic, but it's still pop period. And I just thought, I think Heroes and Villains is a mind-boggling song for, you know, the reason to...
I've always got the feeling about the Beach Boys, whatever, you know, I know it's not quite a 40-year career, but there will be somebody called the Beach Boys probably playing somewhere tonight, you know. But actually, it's 3 years in the middle of it, isn't it? You know what I mean? The golden period of the Beach Boys is a very, very short period of time with incredibly intense productivity.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he must have been in the studio every day. They were knocking something out.
And, of course, it's a totally different experience from a British group because Brian Wilson doesn't have the Beach Boys standing around playing bass and stuff. He's got the cream.
Absolutely.
He's got the musicians who play for with Frank Sinatra.
Yeah. Have you watched that documentary, The Wrecking Crew?
Yes, I have. Is that the Tamla?
No, it's about the LA studio.
Oh, no, I haven't. I've seen the one about the Detroit ones.
The son of Tedesco, the guitar player, made a documentary. I don't know if he ever got it released because I don't think he'd clear all the music, but there are hooky copies.
I love these.
And it's got Carol Kay talking about how she played the bass on These Boots Are Made for Walking and things like that.
There's a little piece in our next issue about Big Jim Sullivan. So Big Jim Sullivan, Jimmy Page, John Paul Jones, bass, Clem Cattini on drums, played on...
it was something astonishing. Oh, at one point, I think Big Jim Sullivan is on something 11... top 10 records in, is it 5 weeks? I think
you wouldn't be surprised.
It's just astonishing. I mean, these guys are on, you know, everything from Donovan Records, Petula Clark Records, obviously Dusty Records, all this. They are the band. And it's just, it's a magical.
Presumably those guys have gone now, have they? Session musicians? Do you still have them, Neil? I suppose they do.
No, you still do. You know, if you want to get a really good guitarist in, you know who to get. I think the thing we're talking about there, it probably did exist in London, but there was more work for it in Hollywood because they would do film scores. And then everyone, you know, you had all Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra tons and tons of people like that making their albums in Capitol Studios, whoever it was. But, I mean, in that same period, when you're talking about Dusty. Dusty was making her albums with, what's he called, somebody, Raymond, or his name is.
Ivor Raymond.
And she'll be using, she's got, you know, John Paul Jones playing bass and all the rest of it, and doing the string arrangement sometimes.
How is it producing Dusty? Tell us, you made a record with Dusty.
We made several records with him.
How was it?
It was...
I know the answer to this, so...
I've probably said it many times. Dusty was a very slow singer, because I think people, particularly nowadays, imagine that the way to be a good singer is to just get in the zone and give it 110 and cry and have lots of emotion. You know,
lower lip
that's,
wobble.
That's what everyone thinks is really amazing, and, you know, I makeup starts to run, and, you know, it's all... and in fact, Dusty, one syllable at a time.
one syllable.
I couldn't believe what
it was like a pantalist version of singing. Dusty in her head took the melody, she had it all in her head, and then she went through it and arranged it so the famous Trevor Horn dictum, every verse and every chorus must be different. Dusty did that in the vocal performance, never mind the backing track. She did that in the performance. And then at the end, it had to have a climax because she was Dusty. And so when we did that song, Nothing Has Been Proved, the film Scandal, which is really, in musical terms, verging on a recitative. It's got very beautiful chords, yeah, and there's just a little up and down melody. Dusty, at the end, it was an astonishing thing, took that, it may be false, it may be true, but nothing's been proved bit, and she gave it this massive climax. Well, it took us 2 days to record this, and I remember when it started, thinking, oh my God, and I'm going to ask her to double track it. And Julian Mendelsohn is our co-producer, that looking at me, you know, raising his eyebrows. But anyway, you know, at the end, it was so worth it.
So she would really sing pretty much a word or a phrase, and that's what she was
aiming
to...
I didn't say a word, I said a syllable. And she dropped them all in. Or probably would be a word, but it was a very slow
But why
process.
Would she adopt that practice?
She was a total and utter perfectionist.
I'm fascinated by this Trevor Horn dictum that you talk about. You would say, I've never heard that before. So every verse, every chorus...
It's a basic principle of pop music.
So there's just got to be some development of some kind.
Every verse has got to be different.
Yeah. Even though it might be only something tiny?
No, it would probably be something major.
Oh, really?
So you mean it's accumulating? You don't mean necessarily
you're adding strings,
you're adding something different on the cymbals.
The third chorus, the big chorus, actually a breakdown, all the rhythm drops out, you know, and then comes back in again.
And is this to do with the number of times people are going to hear it? It's keeping
it's,
it
so
fresh.
So it's not boring.
Right.
But also because so it's not
even though you listen to Zenomania, it enough times to make it
Zenomania, Brian Higgins and I, the only time we ever, when Chris and I did the last album with them, almost had a row, and it wasn't a row, but it was a very heated debate. It was because I said, if you were repeating the lyrics of a chorus, the music had to be different the second time, or the lyrics would have to change the second time. And
fair point.
He blew up. Because I was applying the Trevor Horn dictum, and this is the song Love, Etc. And then, anyway, he then agreed, and we changed, the chorus was repeated, so I changed the lyrics a bit the second time, so it was different.
So how have you found...
But he's pretty much worked out that as well.
Now, your most recent Pet Shop Boys record is music for a ballet.
It is,
which
yes.
must have been very different.
It is. Well, we quite like occasionally writing long pieces of instrumental music, and you know, we did the music for Valtry Potemkin a few years ago, and just because it's interesting, and it's I actually like hearing our music in a sort of theatrical context, and this came about the synchronicity of us knowing a ballet dancer who phoned me up and said, "Would we write a ballet for him?" And totally by chance, Chris phoning up 2 days later and saying he just read this story and thought we'd make a good ballet, and he didn't know about the phone call.
Perfect.
So because of this, we did a Sadler's Wells, put on this ballet last month or the other 4 months, and it comes back next year. And it's been a really engrossing thing, because another interesting thing, like Battleship Potemkin, you're writing music, a bit like you said about Burt Bacharach as well, you're writing music for a purpose. When you're writing a song, pop song, you sit in the studio and you think, what ideas have you got, you know? Oh, this song's been called Western Girls or something. But with this, or with Battleship Potemkin, or when we did the musical, you're making a specific point. You're setting up a scene. With the ballet, you're giving the music for a certain sort of narrative thing to happen to. And it's a really fascinating thing to do. It's
how long did that take?
The whole thing to write probably took about 9 months. We did the first act a few years, over a year before the rest of it. And then we went on, the album came out, Pet Shop Boys album, and then we did the tour and all that. And then we came back to the ballet and wrote Acts 2 and 3 in about 6 months.
We had a basic script. Chord structures, and then
We had a script. Sadler's Wells brought in what they call a dramaturg to turn the 3.5-page story into a 25-page script, a bit like a film script, like a shooting script. And so we started at the beginning and worked through to the end. And also we learned from Archie Potemkin not to be so repetitive. Archie Potemkin, we really wrote 8-bar sections.
Archie Potemkin is different because you're actually, the action is already there.
It's already there.
And so you've got to be in sync with it, haven't you?
Yeah, and with computers, of course, you can sync.
You played that great show at Trafalgar Square.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a question from further questions from The Massive on Twitter. I'm not scared. It says, Neil, are you thrilled when you hear music from Pet Shop Boys being used as backing on BBC radio or TV shows or whatever?
Yes, the last great time that happened was when we were in Liverpool playing a concert, and it was the World Cup when Britain, England, I should say, went out of the World Cup.
And actually, could have been any 4 years.
I don't really watch a lot of football, but I did watch that. And we were in Linda's Hotel in Liverpool, and England went out and all the rest of it. And this music started, and I thought, oh, yeah, I know this. It's like some, it's some classical thing or something. And then I realised it was our... We didn't write it, actually. Diane Warren wrote it. It was Numb from our album Fundamental.
This was the great wrap-up of the...
Yeah.
They did the montage. And you didn't know anything about it?
Nothing.
So they hadn't...
So when it started, I literally thought, oh, God, this is familiar. I know it. What is it again? And then I actually thought, oh, it's Numb. So we... So England went out the World Cup. We were over the moon. We got the montage. I was thought it was fun. I thought it was interesting. The Royal Wedding, the end of it, the montage. And I was wondering whether they were going to use George Michael's record he made for the wedding. And they chose a really strange...
Who did they choose?
Well, they chose She... by Charles Aznavour.
Good God. Sung by a sheep.
But sung by Elvis Costello.
Oh, yes.
From
Notting Hill.
Yeah.
Is it from Notting
from
Hill?
From Notting Hill, yeah. I like that version.
Of course, the Julia Roberts, you know, and the Complers, yeah.
There could have been better Elvis Costello songs even to have used, but I thought it was a very strange choice of song.
Very peculiar.
You must have been asked to be on a judge on Britain's Got Talent or something like that. You must have been.
I was asked to be the headmaster of
Jamie's school.
Oh, the Academy.
Fame Academy.
Fame Academy. Where you're in a house in Hampstead or something. And I haven't been asked to be a judge on Britain's Got Talent, but I was asked if I would like to be considered a Simon Cowell's replacement on American Idol.
No.
Last year.
There's got to be a big wedge in it, surely.
I had a phone conversation with them, but I said no. Actually, you know, I hadn't seen American Idol, and I saw it. I got them to send over a DVD of some episodes.
Why do you think they'd ask for you?
They wanted someone. I think they wanted someone British. And they said, and we had this phone call, they said, oh, we like the way you're so opinionated.
They want the British to be the bad guys, don't they?
Yeah, it's like in the movies.
It's like casting Charles Dance in...
Yeah, you've got to be catty, bitchy, sarcastic. Yeah. Exactly. And the Americans couldn't be wildly enthusiastic and upbeat. And then look at you, askance.
I was quite flattered to be asked.
It's
somebody
amazing.
Also asked, KTEL66, and I don't know where this comes from, but it's not a bad question. Would you consider doing Likely Lads, the musical?
I think that must be some Geordie kind of thing.
You can imagine that, can't you? Not necessarily for you, but...
Deirdre Birchwood.
I can't, no. I guess maybe Billy Elliot's covered that area.
Yeah. And what's your favourite Bob Dylan long ballad? Is it Desolation Row or Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands?
Of those two, I prefer Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands.
I love the idea that the assumption is you've obviously got one. Everyone's got a favourite long ballad.
Of course they have. There aren't that many long Bob Dylan
ballads. I remember saying to Louis Walsh many years ago, you know, there's a really good Bob Dylan... You're going to think I'm taking the piss now, but there's a really good Bob Dylan song that Westlife could do.
It's not a stupid idea at all. What
was it? And he thought, because... A lot of people think that I'm being cynical or ironic when I'm saying these things. Actually, I was being totally serious. And it was, I could make you dreams come true. What is it?
To make you feel my love. Which, yeah. Well, you know, is
well,
done.
Then,
well,
Adele
at the royal wedding. We're back to the royal wedding.
Well, this was the story on Twitter on the day of the royal wedding, that the first dance of the happy couple was going to be to Adele's version of To Make You Feel My Love. And I thought, if you're Bob Dylan, you're 70 this year, that's quite cool.
Because that to be happening.
Because they're never going to ask for Bob Dylan's growling, are they? So,
they found that on the montage too, didn't they?
Yeah.
I think they
had.
Oh, that was the first song on the montage, and then it was She. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I always thought, when that album came out, I thought, well, I was playing these records, Nick, what's the hit? And,
I'm sure Bob Dylan does the same thing, doesn't he?
But then Chris Heath told me that Bob Dylan thought the same thing, so much so that the first person who released that song was not Bob Dylan. Who was it?
Oh, go on.
Billy Joel.
Really?
Yes. And it's actually, unfortunately, not a very good version. Because I downloaded it. And actually, you can see why it wasn't a hit, because he kind of murders it, really.
You must have seen the Bob Dylan film, No Direction. Is it called No Direction Home? The Scorsese film.
Oh, yes.
Where he talks in the early days about Artie Mogul's huge part in his career, doesn't he? You know, everybody, it's really interesting, because everybody thinks of Bob Dylan as being this inner-directed artist. And then Artie Mogul points out that he only got started because people covered his songs. That's what made him famous in the first place.
It's because the Birds and Peter Paul and Mary.
It's Trini Lopez. It's all kinds of corny. Marlene Dietrich, I think, used to do Bob Dylan songs.
She used to do Blowing in the Wind.
Yes. You know, that's what made him famous. Yeah. And so he always had a kind of song publisher's ear.
Actually, Bob Dylan was made famous to the public by Peter Paul and Mary.
People are married.
Doing Blowing the Wind.
Yeah.
Specifically by that song.
Yeah. Which was Albert Grossman's idea, I think. Same with the Beatles. If you look at Paul McCartney, you know, Paul McCartney and John Lennon are sitting there in about 1962. They're on tour with Helen Shapiro. They're writing songs for her in the back of the bus. They're writing, you know, Brian Epstein rings them up and says, you know, Billy J. Kramer's got a slot on Thursday to record something. Bad to me. You know, it's incredible.
I've been having, bizarrely recently, as you say that, a bit of a Billy J. Kramer thing.
My
sister, Susan, bought I'll Keep You Satisfied and Bad To Me. And I was
Bad To Me is a great song.
And I was trying to remember. I remember I always loved the B-side of I'll Keep You Satisfied. I couldn't remember what it was. And suddenly it occurred to me I could look it up on the internet. And it's this song called I Know. And I think it's co-written by George Martin. And it's a great... And anyway, I started listening to those. I'd forgotten the Beatles. I used to write the B-sides of some of those singles as well.
Yeah.
And they definitely... So not only were they... So to return to the George Martin Arena in 1963, didn't he say some statistic about how many weeks he had at number one?
Yeah, and he only got salaried.
Yeah, but he beat Norrie Palmore.
Norrie Palmore. It was all about beating Norrie Palmore.
That mattered to him.
And he had such a chip on his shoulder that he didn't get. I really sympathise. He says in 1963, he's not given. I think everyone got a staff Christmas bonus. They had such a good year, Parlophone.
They didn't give him.
But he didn't, because he was an executive. He didn't get one. And he was still transparently furious about it, wasn't he? And I thought, fair enough.
It was funny that I was annoyed he still was.
Yeah, actually, I've still got a chip on my shoulder.
So we're going for lunch now.
We're
going for lunch.
Starter? What should we have for starters?
Oh, I don't know.
We're having Spanish, aren't we?
I think so. There's something with chorizo sausage.
Yeah, I think so.
And maybe one of those Alhambra beers.
There's a possibility.
In exciting bottles.
Neil, thanks very much for coming in.
Sherry glasses. They have
a very good dry sherry, don't they?
We've got to complete the formalities. Neil, thanks very much for...
Thank you for having me.
The podcast studio. I've got to point out that next week is the 100th issue of Word, and there's a CD comes with it, which has, as well as the normal 15 tracks, it has what we're calling the Notcast. And that's half an hour of audio, which you can only hear if you get the CD. And that's got me and Mark and Paul Denoyer and Kate Mossman.
It sounds like a very clever device. In fact, it'd encourage you to buy the magazine.
It could be. you're not going to hear
can
that.
Can I say, this magazine will be worth buying?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a very, very strong issue.
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, go to wordmagazine.co.uk or apply at your newsagent.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.